No, I thought, who is that stranger? Who is that stranger sitting at that table? All right, everyone. Okay, so I'll call the case again as I compose myself. Case number 14-1124, United States versus Paul Davis Jr. Good morning, Ms. Stack.
Good morning, Your Honor. Again. May it please the Court. My name is Megan Stack, and I represent the government in this matter. The District Court abused its discretion in ordering discovery in this case because defendants failed to make the required showing of discriminatory effect and discriminatory intent.
Before you go even a moment further, I want to talk to you about something. Do we have a final judgment here, given that the indictment was a dismiss without prejudice? You see, here's what I've been thinking about. It seems to me that even if you lose the appeal on the merits, the government could choose to re-indict and comply with the discovery order this time around. So isn't this a heads I win, tails you lose situation for the government?
Your Honor, jurisdiction properly lies here based on the plain language of Rule 3731. 3731 provides that the government may appeal the dismissal of an indictment. There is no language in that statute that distinguishes between dismissals with prejudice and dismissals without prejudice.
Now, there's a question, though, about in terms of the reasoning of our decision in Clay, where, in essence, the problem is, as Judge Rogner was pointing out, this is an eminently curable problem. And under then Circuit Judge Stevens' reasoning for the court in that opinion, we don't have jurisdiction, I don't think.
Well, Your Honor, the only way it would be curable is for the government to simply comply
to
with
comply.
The discovery order. But that is the one we are seeking to address
or
by this appeal.
Either comply with the order or accept dismissal with prejudice as a sanction. We do that all the time in the civil context. I mean, a dismissal without prejudice is not final in a civil case unless, as a practical matter, it's not curable. It's essentially the same standard that's articulated in Clay.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, although technically the government may be free to reindict, that's really an opportunity in name alone. If the government because if the government were to reindict in this case prior to the appeal being decided, for example, we have every expectation that we'd end up in the very same place. We'd have every expectation that the defendants would move for discovery and that
sure,
the court that, would enter
well
the
that,
order.
That, look, that's but, always going to be true when you've got a discovery dispute. Would you agree in general that a discovery order is not appealable?
Yes, Your Honor, and as we conceded that in our briefs, discovery orders are typically not appealable.
Okay.
However, a dismissal certainly is.
Well, it's a dismissal you asked for, if you want to focus just on the dismissal. The question is whether, in essence, a costless dismissal without prejudice should suddenly make all discovery orders against the government appealable.
Your Honor, I don't think it's fair to characterize it as a costless dismissal.
When is the last time a grand jury in Chicago declined to indict?
It's not something that happens often,
this
Your
year?
I don't know.
Last year?
Specifics. Mm-hmm. It's certainly not something that happens often. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, there are certainly costs to the government of going back and presenting the case in its entirety to a new grand jury. But also there are costs to the government in prosecuting the appeal. As you know, the underlying prosecution is put entirely on hold. The
defendants are still in custody, aren't they?
No, a number of the defendants obtained bonds.
Okay.
And so there are certainly costs incurred by the government.
Well, is it the government's intent to dismiss all of these Stash House prosecutions if we were to affirm the discovery order?
No, I can't say that is our intent, Your Honor.
So well, if it isn't, doesn't that demonstrate why the dismissal of indictment without prejudice is not a final order in the sense that you could choose to re-indict and comply with the discovery order?
Your Honor, the test for finality, as articulated in Clay, is whether or not the dismissal effectively terminated the litigation. And for the reasons that we've cited, it essentially did here. We would end up in the same place.
You could make exactly the same argument if the district court, for example, grants summary judgment in a civil case on count one and dismisses count two without prejudice so that the summary judgment in count one can go forward in an immediate appeal or a discovery order is taken up that way. The district judge abused his discretion by ordering this discovery, so we don't want to comply. We agreed to dismiss without prejudice. I mean, we open up the floodgates for interlocutory appeals.
Your Honor,
if there is no significant cost to refusing to comply.
As I've stated, I believe there is significant cost to the government here.
Well, let me ask, if I could, just one more question on that. And I want to talk about the merits with you all, as I'm sure my colleagues do too. But can you point us to cases in which our court, say after Clay, has allowed an appeal from a dismissal without prejudice, where the problem that prompted the dismissal was curable?
Your Honor, I can't think of a Seventh Circuit case in that posture. There are certainly cases from other circuits that permitted dismissals without prejudice to go forward based both on the plain language.
Which are hard to reconcile with Clay.
Right.
Exactly, Your Honor. Well, I'm not sure that that's true, Your Honor. Again, the question here is, did the dismissal effectively terminate the litigation? And given the harm that the government sought to avoid, the dismissal did just that. And the defense certainly has not pointed to a single case where the court has found lack of jurisdiction solely because a dismissal was without prejudice. In fact, as I stated, there are cases from other circuits interpreting the plain language of 3731 and its liberal construction policy to find jurisdiction.
Let's go forward.
With
respect
to...
Because you point out that there is evidence that Davis unilaterally voiced an interest in robbing someone with drugs and or money. So it's your position that if that is true, there can be no selective prosecution claim here. So here's my question. Do you think it's necessary to remand for an evidentiary hearing and a factual determination by Judge Dara as to whether Davis self-selected for a stash house robbery?
Your Honor, we are not asking for a remand at this point. The core question here is the threshold.
I know you're not asking for it, but the problem is that we've got apples and oranges going on. You are maintaining that he self-selected. They're maintaining that he was targeted. Shouldn't Judge Dara have the responsibility of holding a hearing and giving us a factual determination? How do we decide who's who?
Your Honor, the issue of whether or not Mr. Davis self-selected goes directly to the question of whether or not the defendants have established discriminatory intent. It's the government's position that, given that this is in a pretrial posture and that the facts as asserted in the complaint should be accepted as true, there can be no evidence of discriminatory intent in this case because the government did not select any of the defendants. They either self-selected or were selected by each other.
So did Davis approach your CI first?
Correct, Your Honor.
Just out of a clear blue sky?
Well, I believe that Davis and the informant were familiar with each other from the neighborhood, and our evidence shows that Davis first reached out to the informant on a number of occasions inquiring about a robbery opportunity. The informant then followed up with him in a recorded call in which he said, "Hey, remember those things you were asking me about before? And I told you I had a guy who might get us an opportunity." And then from there, the meetings with the undercover took place.
So your view is that this sort of came to the government on a silver platter?
I don't know about a silver platter, but yes, Your Honor.
Tell me about it. I mean,
I think this is certainly not a case where the informant was instructed to go out into the neighborhood and see who he could involve in this type of investigation.
There are other cases like that pending.
There may be, but this is not one of them. This is a case in which Davis first reached out to the informant and expressed an interest in finding robbery opportunities.
But
this,
would you concede that that's not the view of the defense?
I would concede that, but I would also suggest that the defense's view is not well supported by the evidence.
But how
And, Your Honor, if I may, on the subject of discriminatory intent, this is all a bit academic because in the district court, the defense presented zero evidence of discriminatory intent outside of the potential intent that could be inferred from their statistics on effect.
Okay, yeah. So let's assume for purposes of argument here, if we can't resolve the factual issue this morning, let's assume for purposes of argument that Davis was targeted. Defense has come forward with their statistics. And these sting operations are kind of a category unto themselves with respect to the Armstrong test and the relevant comparisons. What do you think the relevant comparison mm-hmm. should be?
In terms of a similarly situated group, Your
yep.
Honor?
Mm-hmm.
Could I just add something to that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course.
Please.
Given that the government holds all the cards in presenting an individual with the opportunity to rob a fictitious stash house. So under that circumstance, what would be a valid comparison group? I mean, I think you have to factor that in.
Well, I would say that there is nothing in the case law that indicates that a similarly situated group should be defined categorically based on the investigative tool.
Give us an answer. What do you think the comparison should be?
The comparison group should be individuals who have sustained prior state or federal convictions for offenses involving robbery, narcotics, or firearms, and individuals who have indicated a willingness to engage in robbery offenses to federal law enforcement.
Why
is that all of the above?
All
or
of the above, Your Honor.
Okay, are there more than a hint? Well, you prosecute all those people. But we're talking here, I thought, about targeting.
Correct, Your Honor.
Why wouldn't the group of just those with federal convictions for narcotics, firearms, and robbery offenses be the right comparison group? Because the defendants in those cases are people who have come up on the federal government's radar, and they're the ones the government would have been most likely to present the opportunity to rob a stash house.
Your Honor, because in this case, all of the defendants had prior state convictions, not federal convictions, and the data for state arrests indicates that the racial breakdown of arrests for the offenses I've cited is almost identical to the racial breakdown of stash house defendants in this district.
Yeah.
And, Your Honor, I see that my time is winding down.
Well, so we're going to give you some more. You say the group should include all those arrested in Cook County, but most of those people aren't going to encounter federal agents and informants, where we know that those who are charged with federal offenses have, in fact, already come across the federal government's radar and thus could have been offered the opportunity. I mean, do you see what I'm saying?
I do, Your Honor, and I'm not sure that's accurate because I think it's far more common that our federal defendants have prior state convictions. It's actually more unusual that they have prior federal convictions. And again, as I stated, in the defendants in this particular case, every single one of them had only state convictions.
Let me ask you one fast question, and we'll give you a couple of extra minutes. Is there any portion of Judge Darrah's discovery order that you would accede to voluntarily?
No, Your Honor, there is not.
Okay.
Thank you,
Thank
Your
Honor.
You.
Okay. Mr. Dice.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Phil Tice. I represent Mr. Davis, although I'm going to be presenting oral argument on behalf of all the appellees.
Say it again.
I'm going to be presenting oral argument on behalf of all the appellees.
Yeah.
First of all, there were some questions about cost to the government and also cost to the to the defendant. I have not kept up on the release status of all the appellees, but I know that my client is still detained, and I think that there are some others who are detained as well. The only one I can say for sure of is my client. So there's certainly a cost to him.
Mr. Tice, there's this threshold question of whether Mr. Davis, in effect, self-selected himself, well, self-selected for the Stash House robbery by expressing an interest in a lick or a twist, which I gather involves the robbery of someone with drugs or money. If there is a factual dispute on that point, then does that dispute have to be resolved before we get to the issue of selective prosecution?
Well, I don't want to be in the position of fearing a factual hearing, but I do want to respond to a couple things that are embedded in your question. The complaint talks about my client inquiring about a lick or a twist, which the affidavit says is Argo for Stash House robbery. Well, there's also some discovery material where they also describe these phrases as Argo for a scheme to make money, not necessarily robbery. But as far as who approached whom first, it was interesting to me that the government stated with such assurance as a definitive fact that my client approached the government first. If you look at the complaint is very carefully worded. It says nothing about my client approaching the government first. There is an allegation that my client asked about a lick or a twist. But as always happens in these cases, since the informant is sort of on his own and the tape recorders haven't been turned on, the government, either by necessity or otherwise, really doesn't know much about what happened before. So it is not a proven or unassailable fact that my client approached the government first about all of this. As a matter of fact, it's pretty implausible. And this is where I want to get back to Judge Dara's approach to all of this. You know, when Judge Dara saw a complaint like this, which is a very well-manicured complaint, he was certainly not obliged to accept something that is pretty implausible.
In complaint, you mean indictment, Mr. Davis?
I mean the complaint, because there was a preliminary hearing complaint that was filed before the indictment.
Before the indictment.
And the complaint sets out a number of facts. It's a
fairly lengthy. You have no quarrel with the indictment.
How can anyone quarrel with an indictment? You know, those are the charges that's what the grand jury
found. People do all the time.
Well, you can defend on the indictment, but I think where the government is coming from is the allegations in the complaint for preliminary hearing, where this sort of half statement is made, which maybe conveys the impression that Davis asked first, but doesn't really say that.
Doesn't the indictment assume everything that went before? Complaint, everything else?
In some ways it does. It certainly doesn't establish that my client approached the informant first. And I think that's maybe where
we're going. So would a remand for an evidentiary hearing and a finding by Judge Dara be appropriate if we
get to the merits?
If you get to the merits, and if that's what you think is best, as I say, I don't want to give the impression I'm afraid of an evidentiary hearing, because I'm pretty convinced that this is going to come out the way these things always come out, that the informant is out there doing his thing, and he's not being recorded, and he's saying all sorts of things. And then once everything is in place, that's when we turn on the tape recorders. And that's all the government's
spoken
really
spoken like a true federal defender.
So we don't have an affidavit from your client, for example, about this.
We do not. And given the some evidence test that Judge Dara was required to apply, the statistics certainly gave him some evidence. Just as those same statistics gave some evidence to Judge Castillo in two separate cases, and gave some evidence to Judge Gettleman in another case, cases which the government is not appealing, and cases where the government is complying, I think, although it's all under a protective order. I can't get to find out what they're complying with or what they're doing. Yes, they have sought and received protective orders. So what we have here is a situation where some defendants are getting discovery on the very same allegations that are made in this case. And in this case, we're not getting discovery, and we can't even get it through the transom because there's a protective order that's in place that would forbid us from learning anything about the discovery that the government is supplying in these mm-hmm. other cases. It's a very unusual situation, and that's why I say Judge Derrick could have all sorts of factual hearings, but the end result is more than likely going to be the same end result that we had in front of Judges Castillo and Gettleman, because what we're looking at this initial stage, where we're not litigating whether there was racial profiling, we're litigating discovery, is whether there is some evidence, enough that the judge wants to find out what happened and make an informed decision. And if it turns out that my client was just begging to steal $1 million worth of cocaine, Judge Dara can certainly take that into account in making any decision on whatever motion would be filed to dismiss for racial profiling. But that's something that would come much later in the game.
Mr. Tice, one question that I had. Armstrong is written as if it is possible to meet its standard.
Yes, it is.
I'm wondering, have any district court orders for such discovery that have been appealed survived on appeal around the country?
To my knowledge, there have been really almost no orders granting discovery except the ones in the Northern District. And I believe that this is the first order granting discovery that is on appeal.
We found a few around the country that were granted and then reversed, but I'm trying to figure out whether the Armstrong standard is an empty set.
I would say no. I would take Armstrong at his word that it's not an empty set. Mm-hmm. And the case that you have before you, although it fits within the Armstrong framework, is very different for two important reasons. These are not crimes that people committed on their own. These are crimes that the government instigated. And secondly, in choosing who to seek out to instigate these crimes, the government uses, I hope, some standards in making that selection, but the standards are a secret. They're in a bank vault.
If he self-selected, would the government have instigated?
I don't know, Your Honor. I really don't know.
See, that's... We don't know either.
It's very hard to accept that he self-selected. This was an informant who, over the years, has received $250,000 from the FBI in informant payments. That really blew my mind. You don't normally see that level of compensation. And
has he been doing it for 70 years?
No, not for 70 years. But to suggest that, you know, the government had this really high-powered informant, and then all of a sudden, Davis sort of dropped into his lap and said, oh, please help me steal a lot of cocaine. Oh, you've got that opportunity. Good to know. I didn't know that. That really beggars reality. And that's the sort of decision that a district judge can very easily make.
Sounds to me like it's a decision a jury ought to make.
Not the jury.
Credibility. And you're attacking the credibility of the informant is what you're doing.
No. Certainly not trying to defend the charges on that basis.
To say over and over again that it defies your ability to comprehend, you can't believe it. It's just a subjective discussion that you don't believe them.
And it's not just my personal opinion. It's the basis of Judge Dara's opinion.
All right, so it's his too.
I think that counts for something. Because we are talking about abuse of discretion.
Not if he doesn't have all the facts before By the way, under Armstrong, don't you have to make some effort to compare the defendants that are charged with in these cases with a group that is more narrow than the overall population of the Northern District of Illinois? I mean, that includes us.
Well, and it includes 10-year-old children who live in the suburbs, but that's the point. We're not talking about crimes that have been committed before the government gets involved. We're talking about crimes that are instigated by the government, and they won't give us the standards. Now, this morning, they sort of suggested there might be valid comparators, but you'll notice they never told you that those are their standards. And so when we're in a situation where the government is instigating the crimes and refuses to say what are the standards are, the comparison with the Northern District of Illinois is a legitimate one. Otherwise, we'd be chasing ghosts. You know, is it people with federal convictions? Is it people with state convictions? Would it be people with smoking marijuana cigarette convictions or people who rob stash houses?
Well, that does strike me as a comparison that's more viable under Armstrong, but have you waived it by waiting until now to make that comparison?
We're not asking for that, Your Honor. We litigated this case on the basis that the comparison group is the population at large, given the circumstances of this case. And the government said, no, we're not going to tell you what the criteria are. That's the only basis on which anybody can...
Has the government articulated the standard proposed today before in this litigation?
You know, in their brief, there was, in their brief before this court, there was some very short reference to people with guns, drugs, and firearms convictions. But in their reply brief, they talked about and suggested that maybe we should be comparing the people in our cases to the people in the 3rd Police District of the city of Chicago. Now, once again, they didn't say that was the comparison they actually used. That's why I say they're asking all of us to chase ghosts.
Well, one of the problems here is that this is just a debate about discovery, not about what the ultimate standard is going to be, right?
Correct. It is a debate about discovery.
And speaking of that, could you tell me whether you think that the sort of limited production and discovery that Judge St. Eve ordered would or wouldn't help you make a prima facie showing under Armstrong?
I suppose some is better than none, but I don't see the discovery ordered by Judge St. Eve as going far enough. And of course, you know, the government had all sorts of opportunities to say, we think you're asking for a little too much. How about a little bit less? And they never made that play. It's always been all or nothing. And they're here today on the basis of all or nothing.
Well, yes, because I asked that question.
Well, even before you asked it, they've always been.
No,
Yeah.
But today's the day that counts.
it is, but, you know, here's the point. None of us are really in a position to start drafting a different discovery order when, you know, there's never been any effort on the government's part to get Judge Darrow to draft a different discovery order.
Did you add 2 minutes for Mr. Tice?
Oh.
Yeah, because we're going to give Ms. Stack 2 more minutes. Your white light's on again.
Okay, so I'm back to 2 minutes. Well, we've spent a lot of time talking about discriminatory effects, and we've set out our position about discriminatory intent. I don't know if the court has any questions about that, and I'd certainly want to address those to the extent that the court has them.
If it makes you nervous, go ahead and tell us about it.
I'm not nervous at all.
I know you're not. You're cool as a cucumber.
The case is particularly Alomar from the Second Circuit and Thorpe from the Sixth Circuit have stressed that when we're talking about these discovery matters, that discriminatory effect is something that the court can consider in dealing with intent. And it's not just the statistics of who's been chosen. What drives home the point here is that the criteria for the selection are not known, and in that sense are arbitrary. And to that extent, it's like Yik Wo and Castaneda, where you've got people making decisions on either no standards or on standards that are not disclosed. Those were actually merits type cases in Yik Wo and Castaneda, and when we're dealing with discovery, it seems to me that it's much harder for the government to say that there's been an abuse of discretion on the district court's part when he ruled that there was some evidence of intent. You know, it is kind of interesting. Normally in these cases, when we talk about abuse of discretion, it's a terrible hurdle for the defense. In this case, the government acts like abuse of discretion is really no big deal, but, you know, we get to examine.
All crime investigation and prosecution is subjective. That is, that somebody has to make a decision. It's a subjective decision.
Right.
And by the separation of powers theory, it's their business, not ours.
I think, as Judge Gettleman pointed out in Paxton, in this case, we're not talking so much about the U.S. Attorney's decisions.
I'm talking about abstract. Well, okay. U.S. Attorney, who else are you talking about?
We're talking about the investigating agencies.
The investigating agency reports to the U.S. Attorney, who then makes the decision.
That is true. Yeah. But the initial decisions here about whom to select and how they're selected are made by essentially the police.
So your investigation is of the people who work for the Department of Justice as investigators as opposed to prosecutors.
That is the insight that Judge Gettleman's Paxton opinion gives us.
As long as I know where we're supposed to be going.
Thank you, Mr. Dice. Well, she used up, and we only gave him two extra minutes.
Your Honor, if the showing made by the defendants in the district court in this case were sufficient to justify the order that was entered, discovery would be permitted in every case where the class of defendants, where one race is overrepresented in the class of defendants, And that is certainly not the standard of Armstrong. That result would completely obliviate the rigorous standard enunciated by Armstrong. The defendants in this case made no showing of discriminatory effect. By comparing the defendants in this case to the entire adult population of the district, they failed to show any disparate treatment by similarly situated individuals.
In the district court, what comparison did you suggest would be relevant?
In the district court, we certainly pointed out that to be honest, Your Honor, I'm not sure that we did suggest a comparison group in the district court. Because this is the defendant's burden in the first instance, our response was that they hadn't met the burden enunciated by Armstrong.
Okay, but you're entitled to play it that way if you want to, but you also take your chances. In this case, did I understand you correctly to be saying you think the relevant population would be people who have prior robbery, firearm, or drug convictions, state or federal?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. What about geographic area?
Your Honor, I certainly think that the case law would support a geographic component to the similarly situated definition. For example, this court's decision in Barlow limited the similarly situated group to individuals in a particular waiting room of Union Station who engage in a particular behavior. So the case law supports the notion that the similarly situated group should be defined by reference to the material facts of this case.
So what's the relevant geographic area?
In this case, the defendants were either located or associated with the Chicago Police Department's 3rd District.
These are things that you undertake in a much broader geographic area, right? These types of cases.
Correct, Your Honor.
So,
but in this particular investigation, and it's these defendants who are claiming they were selectively prosecuted.
It's like saying these defendants are these defendants. Okay. So what would be a more realistic geographic comparison?
One potential may be high crime areas where the government tends to focus its enforcement energies. Another comparison may be the entire city of Chicago, perhaps. It's certainly, we have occasionally done stash house investigations outside the city, but my guess is many of them are...
What are your druthers? Because, you know, you've thrown a lot of stuff out here. What are your druthers?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Your Honor.
What do you want to do? What we are requesting
is that the court vacate the dismissal
and reverse
the discovery
as
order.
As to the geographic.
I think in this case, if the record were developed more carefully, this information is not really in the record at this point, but if it were developed.
So now.
That's why this is an interlocutory appeal, but that's
right.
But.
Again, Your Honor, I think that that if a more developed factual record would show that this investigation was tied to a particular area of Chicago and intended to address violent crime problems in a particular area. So with those facts in the record, then I think it would be fair to define the similarly situated group with reference to that particular area. But again, we didn't get into these fine distinctions in the district court, Your Honor, because the defendants did not even come close to making an adequate showing. What they presented to the district court was nearly identical to what was rejected by the Supreme Court in Armstrong. And so in response, you know, it wasn't the government's position to make the defendants' case for them. They proffered a totally insufficient showing in the first instance, and we responded with the argument that that showing was insufficient. And this is their burden. And so to the extent the similarly situated group should be narrowed, that is really on the defendants to come up with an appropriate definition. Your Honor, and again, with respect to the showing in the district court, our position has been that the showing of discriminatory effect was wholly insufficient, and the accompanying showing of discriminatory intent was equally insufficient. In fact, the district court made no finding whatsoever as to discriminatory intent in the discovery order. And Armstrong and Chavez and Barlow decisions from this court have repeatedly held that an adequate showing on both prongs of both effect and intent is required. With that, Your Honor, we would respectfully request that you vacate the dismissal and reverse the discovery order. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Tyson. Thank you, Ms. Stack. The case will be taken under advisement. Thank you very much.